Standing by. All participants will be able to listen only until the question and answer session of the call. At that time, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I will turn the meeting over to Alicia Downs. Ms. Downs, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for today's COCA conference call on Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever and Human Parapox Virus. We are pleased to have Dr. David Swerdlow and Dr. Edith Letterman here with us to speak about these topics. Dr. David Swerdlow is the team leader of the Disease Assessment and Epidemiology Team in the Rickettsial Zoonosis Branch of the Division of Viral and Rickettsial Diseases at the National Center for Zoonotic, Vector-Borne, and Enteric Diseases at CDC. The branch studies rickettsial infections in the United States and abroad. He is also Clinical Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Infectious Diseases at Emory University School of Medicine, and an Adjunct Associate Professor at Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health. Dr. Edie Letterman is a U.S. Navy Infectious Diseases Physician, currently in her second year of her EIS Fellowship with the Pox Virus Program. She has conducted investigations on monkeypox, parapox viruses, vaccinia, Rift Valley fever, acute skin disease among roofers, bloodstream infections, foodborne illness, malaria, Ehrlichia, and rickettsia. The objectives for today's call are for clinicians to identify routes of transmission of parapox viruses and rickettsia, identify current diagnostic techniques available for confirmation of parapox virus and rickettsial infections, and to distinguish human parapox virus infections from cutaneous anthrax using clinical and historical information. Dr. Swerdlow, you may begin.
Thank you very much. I'm really glad to be here this afternoon to talk about some diseases that we think are pretty important. I assume everybody has the slides up. The first slide is just an introductory slide, and then we'll go to the second slide, which describes tick-borne infectious diseases in the United States. There are several tick-borne infectious diseases in the United States, including Lyme disease, Ehrlichiosis, Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, Babesioses, etc. Today we will be focusing on Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. However, in the end I'll show a little data that suggests that Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, as well as the other diseases, all seem to be increasing in incidence in the United States. Next slide. Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever is the most severe rickettsial illness of humans, and it's caused by an organism called Rickettsia rickettsii. It was first noted as a disease way back in 1896, and it's endemic to the Americas, and cases are reported in both North and South America. Until recently, there were about 300 to 800 cases in the United States every year, but as we'll see at the end, that number has increased lately. Well, why are we concerned about this illness? First of all, it's widely distributed with significant morbidity and mortality. It can be very difficult to diagnose because the presentation is very nonspecific. But perhaps most important, rapid diagnosis and treatment prevents death. And as we'll see, it's very important to be able to recognize the illness and start antibiotics quickly in order to prevent death. Next slide. This slide says general properties on the top. The organisms, the rickettsial organisms in general, are small coccobacillary bacteria. They're slow growing, and they are intracellular. This slide shows stains for rickettsia rickettsii, and as you can see, the organism is intracellular. Next slide. This slide says background, the primary tick vectors of Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. There are two main vectors, tick vectors of Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever in the United States. On this slide, the yellow represents the areas where the tick is found. And so Dermacentia variabilis is the American dog tick, is found widely on the East Coast and then also in the Pacific region, whereas Dermacentia andersoni, the Rocky Mountain wood tick, is located in the western region of the United States. The next slide, Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever incidence by county, shows data from 1997 to 2002. And as you can see, the incidence of Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever is highest in the mid-central region, south region of the United States. North Carolina is a very area with a lot of disease, but it extends over to other states such as Oklahoma. However, cases have been reported from all 48 states on the continental United States. The next slide describes the epidemiology and patient demographics. And over 90% of cases occur during April through September. There is peridomestic acquisition, which may account for majority of the cases. Many people may think that you get tick-borne diseases when you're out backpacking or hiking in the wilderness, but in fact, many people become ill and probably acquire their illness closer to home. The age-specific incidence is highest in children, with the disease being more frequent in males, probably because of varying exposure frequencies in males. There are also some clusters of infections in highly endemic areas. Next slide, clinical manifestations. Early on, the symptoms can be very vague and can be sound like many other diseases, and that's really one of the main problems with being able to recognize Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. Early on, you can have high fever, severe headache, myalgias, and interestingly, gastrointestinal symptoms, particularly nausea and vomiting. Later on, you will get rash, photophobia, confusion, ataxia, seizures, cough, trouble breathing, arrhythmias, jaundice, and severe abdominal pain. But many of those symptoms only occur later on in the illness. The laboratory is a little bit helpful, although there aren't that many characteristic findings. Patients frequently have thrombocytopenia and hyponatremia. There are many severe long-term sequelae to Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever infections. And those include CNS deficits, amputations, etc. I'd like to talk a little bit more about the rash on the next slide. The rash, and this is critical when you're thinking about making the diagnosis, the rash generally is not apparent until 2 to 5 days after onset of fever. It begins as 1 to 5 millimeter macules, typically on the ankles, wrists, and forearms, which then spreads to the trunk. The actual petechial rash occurs even later as these macules gradually evolve into petechial lesions, and that occurs on or after day 6. Unfortunately, for the diagnostician, the rash may be asymmetric, localized, or even absent, and probably about 10% of patients never develop a rash. The next slide shows a sort of typical petechial stage of Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever rash. Again, more common on the hands and wrists, ankles, but it does progress to include the whole body. The next slide shows three pictures of rashes. And as you can see, these are not quite as characteristic. Some of these are not quite as characteristic as the petechial rash we saw before. So sometimes the rash just doesn't look exactly like what the books say, and it can be very difficult to identify. Again, there are severe sequelae, and the pathological basis for the sequelae is the fact that this organism affects endothelial cells, particularly of small blood vessels. So the main pathology is associated with a vasculitis, and so you can get digit necrosis or cerebral events, et cetera, because of the vasculitic nature of this illness. Well, as I said several times, initially it can be very difficult to diagnose this illness. Frequently, the illness is thought to be a viral illness, fever of undetermined etiology, bacterial sepsis, or upper or lower respiratory tract infections, or even things like acute appendicitis or cholecystitis, mainly because of the nausea, vomiting, and abdominal symptoms that can occur with the initial presentation. The next slide is a table of the differential diagnoses of Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, and we won't go through the whole table today, but you can review that afterwards. But some of the other diseases that are important to rule out include meningococcal infections, enteroviral infections, and measles. And you certainly want to rule those other illnesses out or treat for both illnesses if you're not sure you know what it is. Because if you don't treat Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, you can have death. And if you don't treat other diseases like meningococcal infections, you can also have death. So there are times when you may want to be treating for both. Well, how do you confirm Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever infection with Rickettsia rickettsii? There are several laboratory diagnostics that you can use. Serology is the most common, and probably the best way to do that is using indirect immunofluorescence assay, or ISA. But there are commercially available ELISAs and other ways of looking at serology as well. Immunohistochemical staining and polymerase chain reaction, PCR, can also be used, in particular on biopsy specimens taken from skin lesions, skin biopsies of rash lesions, particularly if they're petechial, has a good sensitivity and specificity for diagnosing the organism. Culture can be done, but usually that's only found at a few high-level safety labs in the United States. The problem with the next slide shows serologic diagnosis of Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. The problem with serologic diagnosis of Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever is that 85% of patients lack diagnostic titers in the first week of illness, and many people will lack diagnostic titers even 7 to 9 days after illness. So what that means is that in order to make the correct diagnosis, you need to test both acute and convalescent samples to be able to identify increases associated with this infection. The ISA assay is a quantitative assay, and so you can actually detect fourfold rises in titers, which is what we use to say that a patient definitely had Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. The ELISA, which is actually one of the commercially available tests available now, is not quantitative, so that it can say if it's a positive or negative. But if you do acute and convalescent samples, you're not going to be able to say that there was a fourfold or an eightfold rise between the acute and convalescent samples. So it's really more, makes it more difficult to really confirm the infection using that test with serology. Well, the next slide shows deaths attributable to Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. And the case fatality ratio was as high as 20 to 30% in the pre-antibiotic era. The case fatality rate was highest in adult, older adults and in males. And it should be noted that the disease can kill otherwise healthy adults and children. In addition, the clinical progression may be rapid with a median time to death of 8 days. The next slide is a graph showing Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever deaths in the United States from 1940 to 1997. And as you can see, from 1940 to the 1990s, the death rate went down tremendously. And the reason for that was the use of appropriate antimicrobial therapy. So the next slide shows Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever treatment. And tetracyclines are the drugs of choice for Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, and the clinical response should be within 24 to 72 hours. Chloramphenicol is an alternative therapy for some patients with Rocky Mountain spotted fever. However, the oral formulation of that is not available in the United States right now. Other broad-spectrum antimicrobials are characteristically ineffective, such as penicillin and Bactrim and other things you may be using for patients coming in with febrile illnesses. This slide shows antimicrobial therapy of Rocky Mountain spotted fever and suggests the appropriate dosages for doxycycline or chloramphenicol if a patient is pregnant. You can review that at your leisure. The therapy should be continued at least 72 hours after defervescence and until there is evidence of clinical improvement. I think the key to all this is, as I said before, that you really need to act before you'll know all the information, before you'll have all the tests back, et cetera. In order to prevent death from Rocky Mountain spotted fever, you really need to start treating before you will have laboratory confirmation. So it's really an empiric diagnosis and treatment based on suspicion. The next slide is Rocky Mountain spotted fever prevention. And, of course, it's very important for there to be disease awareness and recognition. Use of protective clothing and repellents is also important. Avoidance of tick areas can be helpful. It is generally not recommended to use antimicrobial prophylaxis following a tick bite. And careful inspection for ticks and prompt removal after returning from outdoors, in particular during the spring and summer, is important. There is a grace period. The exact number of hours is unclear, but probably about 6 hours where if the tick is attached, where before you will actually have inoculation of the organism into a person. So you do have this grace period between the time of the tick attachment and the time when infection would occur. This next slide, called Prevention and Control, shows some specific information regarding prevention, wearing light-colored clothing, tucking your pants, and applying repellent, and you can look at that. The next slide, Prevention and Control Continued, describes performing a tick check and removal, and you would want to use fine-tip tweezers, and there's a little diagram of showing that you put the tweezers right at the skin. And then the next diagram shows that you just gently pull straight ahead without crushing the tick and pull straight out. The next slide is surveillance and reporting. And Rocky Mountain spotted fever is a nationally reportable disease, so cases should be reported to the state health departments. The reports then are submitted to CDC. Just wanted to go over a little bit of the epidemiology of what we've been seeing recently. And as you can see from this slide, which shows Rocky Mountain spotted fever cases and incidence, the numbers of cases in the last 5 or 6 years has really increased dramatically, going from about 500 cases to up to 1,000 cases in 2005. This next slide shows top reporting states and cases, including Missouri, Arkansas, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and North Carolina. And as you can see, over the last 5 to 6 years in those states in particular, there have been some pretty significant increases in cases. One of the questions we have about that is that solely Rocky Mountain spotted fever, or are there other tick-borne illnesses that are also seeing increases? And while we're not going to go into detail on the other tick-borne illnesses, I just wanted to show you quickly a couple of other slides. And this slide, the next slide, human ehrlichiosis cases, shows about 10 years of human ehrlichiosis cases. And as you can see, although there have been some changes in the reporting systems and case definitions, et cetera, clearly there still has been a marked increase in number of cases. Just quickly, the next slide shows spread of ehrlichiosis cases in one particular state, Wisconsin. And on the left, you can see that in 2002, there were a few counties affected, but that in 2005, there were many more counties affected. And the following slide shows the same data from Minnesota. Finally, this data is not from our group here, but it is from CDC, and it shows increases in Lyme disease cases as well reported to CDC. So there are many possible reasons why there have been increases in cases of Rocky Mountain spotted fever and maybe the other tick-borne diseases, but it's, this slide shows that it could be surveillance issues, you know, increased reporting, increased knowledge of the disease. It could be a diagnostic test reasons. It could be associated with human behavior changes, such as increased contact with ticks. And it could also be ecological reasons, for example, people moving to suburban areas, climate changes, changes in areas where the ticks are present. So in summary, a Rocky Mountain spotted fever is a potentially life-threatening disease. It's endemic throughout much of the United States. There's a broad differential diagnosis, and early disease is difficult to diagnose, even for experienced physicians. Confirmatory assays include serology and also polymerase chain reaction immunopathology or isolation from biopsies. And you should consider Rocky Mountain spotted fever as a cause of unexplained fever in spring and summer. And doxycycline is the drug of choice regardless of age. You may have all heard that it's not always recommended to give doxycycline to children, but it's felt that the short course of therapy and is probably not a risk, as well as it's felt that the risks and benefits support the use of doxycycline regardless of the age. So that is all I was wanting to cover on Rocky Mountain spotted fever. There are some additional slides at the end describing an investigation of Rocky Mountain spotted fever in Arizona where a new tick vector, a different tick vector, the Rhipicephalus sanguineus brown dog tick, was identified as the cause of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And we'll have to see in the next few years whether it turns out that that tick is a cause of illness in other parts of the United States. And finally, I'd like to acknowledge Christopher Paddock, John Openshaw, and Jennifer McQuiston for supplying many of the slides that I used in this talk today. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sorbo. That was a very informative presentation. We will now hear from Dr. Letterman. Dr. Letterman, you may begin.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. It's my pleasure to speak to you today about an investigation of human parapox infections which occurred in Missouri State, and gives us an opportunity to discuss the clinical, epidemiologic, and molecular aspects. Going on to slide 2, the objective, to identify routes of transmission of parapox viruses from animals to humans, to identify current diagnostic techniques available for confirmation of parapox virus infections at CDC, and finally to distinguish between human parapox virus infections and cutaneous anthrax using clinical and historical information. Next slide. The overview of this presentation today will include background on parapox viridae, specifically focusing on orphan pseudocalpox viruses, which were involved in this outbreak, then some background on the investigation itself, both the field and laboratory components, the investigation results, the conclusions, and finally the limitations. Next slide. Parapox viridae is a very diverse genus of pox viruses, which include orphvirus, pseudocalpox virus, bovine papular stomatitis virus, as well as field pox virus. These viruses cause cutaneous and mucosal disease in the specific animal hosts that they affect, specifically orphvirus among sheep and goats and pseudocalpox virus among dairy cattle. Next slide. These are common diseases of ruminants, that is, orphvirus and pseudocalpox. Infections occur in animals via either direct contact with infected animals or environmental contact, and specifically for ORF, if they've been vaccinated with the ORF vaccine, which is a live, unattenuated vaccine. These are very common diseases, as I've mentioned. For example, 40% of flocks in the United States have been infected with orvirus in the past 3 years. And these infections occur most commonly in the spring, which coincides with livestock birth and exposure to susceptible newborns. Next slide. These infections are zoonotic diseases, orvirus and pseudocalpox, the incidence of which in humans is unknown currently. This is probably because the diseases are not reportable. They occur in rural areas. They occur in populations due to occupational or avocational exposures, and these populations are familiar with the diseases and therefore may not seek medical attention. And for the most part, these infections are self-limited. You'll notice from the photographs above of ORF and pseudocalpox virus that they appear clinically indistinguishable and therefore have been lumped into a group known as barnyard parapox viruses. These infections, however, do last a long time, anywhere between 4 to 8 weeks. They may be very painful and may become super infected. Electron microscopy and serology cannot distinguish between these parapox viruses. You would have to use molecular tools such as PCR. Next slide. I did want to mention, though, that in hosts with significant immune compromise, these infections can become quite severe and progressive and require medical and or surgical therapy, just as in this case of ORF infection in a patient with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Next slide. For the reason that we conducted this investigation, between the months of February and May in 2006, there were 4 human cases of parapox virus infections reported to CDC in the state of Missouri. 2 of the cases were initially diagnosed as cutaneous anthrax, expending very limited public health resources. There was one child who was barred from school because of communicability concerns. And in 1 month, fair season was to begin in Missouri, so there was concern as to whether the general public was at risk to these infections. The next slide. So the objectives of our investigation in Missouri were to decide whether or not there was a true increase in disease or was this simply an increase in reporting. And was there a common source for these infections, for example, a sale barn or the use of the ORF vaccine? We do know as baseline that over the past 2 years, Missouri has only reported 1 case of parapox virus infection to the CDC. We also wanted to determine if there was still a lingering risk to humans, i.e. infected animals, and were there health messages that we could provide to minimize the future risk. And finally, there were 2 cases misdiagnosed as cutaneous anthrax. Were there potential messages that we could provide for primary care providers to prevent this in the future? The next slide. And go on to the next slide, which is investigation methods. During this investigation, we used a number of standardized survey tools, separate tools for the cases for random livestock handlers in the community, as well as local veterinarians. You'll see to the right of the slide, there's a photograph of some of the aids that we used specifically for our control population in livestock handlers to help jog their memory when discussing disease in humans and animals. Next slide. The surveys of community farmers that we conducted dealt with a number of questions, including demographics, the occupational exposure, the degree of animal exposure that they had on a regular basis, whether or not they've had parapox virus infections in their animals, and their personal history of parapox virus infections. And finally, we also explored whether or not they use non-porous gloves while dealing with infected animals and whether or not they use the ORF vaccine if they had sheep. These surveys were conducted at neighboring farms as well as county and state fairs among livestock exhibitors. The next slide. We also conducted a very brief survey of veterinarians. We asked veterinarians what their experience was with animals and humans infected with parapox virus infections, as well as their knowledge of use of the ORF vaccine in their community. Next slide. In addition, we were able to visit a number of case and neighboring farms in order to do sampling of animals and the environment. Next slide. These specimens were assessed via molecular analysis using parapox virus real-time assays, both for genus and species. Next slide. Now we'll review the results. The next slide. This slide shows a map of Missouri and demonstrates the geographic distribution of both cases as well as neighboring farms of which we were able to conduct interviews on as well as collect specimens of animals and the environment. Next slide. During the fielding investigation, we found that the primary 4 cases were evenly split between males and females, and their ages ranged between 10 to 41 years of age. Their primary risk factors included being infected on a family farm, that was all of the cases, and 3 of 4 of the cases were participating in bottle feeding of young infected animals. Gloves were not worn in any case when handling the ill animals. We also would like to explore whether or not there had been any animal movement on and off of these farms. And 3 of 4 of the farms had no new animals in the past year, and the only access to other animals that they may have had was during showing the animals at fairs. And during our investigation, none of the animals at the case farms had overt parapoxvirus infection. And finally, none of the animals none of the farms used the ORF vaccine. Next slide. Although we didn't detect any further human cases at the primary case farms, we did find 2 cases of convalescing ORF virus infection in humans at one of the neighboring farms. These cases were confirmed by serology. Both of these individuals were bottle feeding sick kids, and we did not find any evidence that would link these cases to the primary cases. The next slide. We did find plenty of ORF virus, however, when we visited neighboring farms. 3 of 5 neighboring farms had overtly infected animals, and during an investigation at the state farm, as you would expect, none of the animals had any overt infections. Next slide. There were approximately 17% of livestock handlers who reported a history of parapoxvirus infections. We compared individuals with and without a history of parapoxvirus infections and found only 2 risk factors associated with infection, that is male sex with an odds ratio of 5, and whether or not they observed infected animals in their own herd or flock with an odds ratio of almost 8. Next slide. We did a crude burden of disease estimate amongst those individuals with parapoxvirus infection. We found that 6 infections per 1,000 person years, or really farm years, among this population of Missouri farmers. So in other words, if an average farmer should work 30 years, then 18% of all of those exposed farmers would have at least 1 parapoxvirus infection in their lifetime. Next slide. We found some interesting results among the veterinarians in these counties. Nearly 50% of them had at some point been consulted for human ORF virus infection at one point in their career, and 11% for pseudocowpox. And about a third of them were aware of ORF vaccine use amongst local farmers. Next slide. Our laboratory evaluation revealed that at case farms, we only had 1 positive animal at the time of the investigation, which was a calf specimen. And we were able to match that specimen to the primary human specimen for pseudocowpox. The interesting results, however, were at the neighboring farms and the state fair. 100% of the animals that we tested that had clinical disease were confirmed positive by PCR. And even more interestingly, 22% of asymptomatic animals, including animals at the state fair, were positive by PCR for parapoxvirus. We also found 1 fomite, specifically an artificial nipple, which you'll see in the photograph at the right lower corner, was also positive by PCR. Next slide. The next slide on conclusions. So in summary, parapoxvirus infections are common in Missouri livestock, specifically in target species, as well as their handlers. We felt that it was important to educate the target human population, i.e. farmers and livestock handlers, and have subsequently created a frequently asked questions sheet, which is available on the CDC website. Also, parapoxvirus infections in humans may be confused with alarming clinical entities such as cutaneous anthrax, and we felt that focused education for primary health care providers and public health professionals is warranted. Next slide. This is an example of the educational materials that we've created as a result of this investigation. This, as I mentioned, this frequently asked question sheet is geared towards the industry, has been co-authored by CDC and APHIS, and is available on both websites, and the website link is provided below. Next slide. As far as determining or differentiating parapoxvirus infections from cutaneous anthrax, I think it boils down to 2 key points. Number 1 is the history of the health of the animals involved. If asymptomatic or minimal disease is present, then you're not dealing with anthrax. Anthrax rapidly kills animals, usually within 24 to 48 hours. In addition, it's useful to look at the geographic distribution of previous cases of anthrax. Bacillus anthracis is not routinely found in all U.S. soil. So the concept that anyone in the U.S. could go in their backyard and grow anthrax in the soil is probably not true. And it occurs where previously infected animals have died. The major epizootics in the previous decades have occurred in North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Texas, with occasional cases in New Mexico, Nevada, California, and Montana. So if you're dealing outside of those states, then this is not a direct infection of cutaneous anthrax from livestock. Next slide. Also, the parapoxvirus infections on these three case farms and the four cases do not appear to have a common source. We've decided that this is likely an increase in reporting, probably because of the confusion with anthrax and activation of the public health system, as well as the timely release of an MMWR in February of that year. Next slide. We've also determined that veterinarians may be consulted for human disease, specifically parapoxvirus infections, and this may be contributing to under-recognition of the disease amongst human physicians. Furthermore, transmission to humans appears to occur most often with bottle and tube feeding, and that is the primary risk factor in our population. Next slide. We've also determined that fomites may be an important route of transmission from animal to animal, for example, the common nipple that we found to be positive by PCR in our investigation. Asymptomatic animals appear to shed virus, and the ORF vaccine, although used in this community, does not appear to be related to these human cases. Next slide. There are a number of limitations which are worth mentioning, however. We would imagine to have significant recall bias, given the fact that we were asked for farmers to recall medical history from their past, and there is some question as to the accuracy of their own diagnosis. The farmers were selected via convenience sampling, so the results are not necessarily generalizable across the United States. And furthermore, currently there's a lack of a reliable culture system such that the results from the PCR only determine that there's a presence of DNA. We don't actually know whether or not this is viable virus and thus still infective to humans. The next slide. I'd like to acknowledge the many partners that took place in this, that were wonderful supporters in this investigation. And I think Dr. Swerdlow and I would be happy to take any questions at this time.
Thank you, Dr. Letterman. That was very informative. We can now open up the lines for the question and answer session. Please address your question to the respective speaker.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press *1, unmute your line, and record your first and last name when prompted. To withdraw your question, you may press *2. Once again, to ask an audio question, please press *1. We do have a question from Curtis Fritz. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Dr. Ann Temka from the California Department of Health Services, sitting here with Dr. Fritz. I have a question for Dr. Swerdlow. This is concerning Rocky Mountain spotted fever. We had a case reported to us or come to our attention where she initially presented with a rash. She was a seronegative at that time, and then was treated as if she had Rocky Mountain spotted fever, recovered, and then 3 to 4 weeks later had a follow-up titer pulled and remained negative. So the case never made it into our surveillance system, but there was a question, is there such a thing as a seronegative Rocky Mountain spotted fever? And I found a couple of references, but not really supported in the literature, and I was wondering if you had any comment on that.
Well, there is this concept that perhaps antibiotic therapy blunts the immune response, but we actually think that that's fairly rare, and it would be unusual for a person to have full-blown Rocky Mountain spotted fever with a rash not to develop an immunological response. It would have been interesting in retrospect if we could have gotten some tissue from that patient and done PCR or culture or IHC on that patient. But that would be very rare to have no antibody response. I assume you looked at IgM and IgG and
Yeah, we looked at, and we did all the follow-up serology, and we didn't do anything beyond serology, though, because, you know, the rash and the testing was, you know, done well before it came to our attention.
Right. Yeah, that's the way it, you know, usually happens. And, you know, the serology group here in our branch, you know, feels that most people should develop a response, even though theoretically there's this discussion about blunting associated with proper treatment. It's really thought to be not really an issue in clinical, in the real clinical world.
Thank you. Our next question is from Alvaro Mesa, Miami-Dade County Health Department. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. This question is for Dr. Letterman. You said, I'm sorry about the ignorance, but why do we call these viruses parapox viruses and not just simply pox viruses, which because that's what they are?
Yes, sir. Thank you for the question. Yes, of course they are pox viruses, but the specific genus of which they fall under is the parapox virus genus. Does that clarify?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Amir Wolf, Ford Motor Company, your line is open. I'm sorry, he disconnected. Scott Norton, American Academy of Dermatology, your line is open.
Yes, this question is for Dr. Letterman. In the past few years, we've heard about small outbreaks of ORF shortly after the Muslim festival of Eid al-Adha, when the faithful will handle sheep or goats. We just had Eid al-Adha about 2 months ago. Have we had any outbreaks recorded after that holiday?
Yes, thank you for the question, Dr. Norton. To my knowledge, in the United States, we have not had any cases associated with the sacrifice of animals. I think, though, that in the U.S., the frequency of home slaughter is probably pretty rare, so that the exposure to the general public would be unusual.
Thank you.
Once again, to ask a question, press star 1. One moment, please. Next question is from Anita Evangelista, Basic Care Clinic. Your line is open.
Thank you. Wonderful discussion today. I wanted to find out if exposure to and acquiring Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever or ORF provides long-term immunity to future exposures, and if so, how long?
Thank you very much for that question. I'll go ahead and answer the parapox virus question, and then David, I'm sure, will be happy to answer the Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever question. It's a great question, and actually we don't know the answer to that. We do know that both humans and animals can be reinfected with parapox viruses, so that it's unclear how long, if any, or if at all, if the immunity is long-term.
Thank you.
Next question is from John Adelini, Illinois Department of Public Health. Your line is open.
Thank you. I was wondering if Dr. Swerdlow could address infection with Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever in the absence of a tick bite, such as removing ticks from a pet.
Well, yes, that brings up two important issues. One is that many people don't recall having a tick bite, and so that somewhere around 50 or 60% of people may not recall having a tick bite at all. So if someone has what looks like Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, but they've been in areas where there have been ticks, you should still suspect the organism. Addressing your specific question, yes, you can, if you crush a tick or get any of the feces from the tick into a place where it can infect you, so that would usually be mucous membranes.
What about
such as your eyes, et cetera. you could indeed transmit Rocky Mountain spotted fever. That's one of the reasons that when we recommend that people pull ticks from themselves or from their children, that they be very careful not to crush the tick and not to get any of the fecal material from the tick or any of the crushed tick on their fingers and where they could then potentially be touch their eyes or another mucous membrane. So yes, you do have to be careful that the organism could spread via mucous membrane contact with the tick material. It's one interesting thing is that we always talk about this window period where it takes, you know, about 6 hours for a tick that's feeding to be able to transmit Rocky Mountain spotted fever, to transmit the organism to a host, a patient. However, it doesn't take that kind of time with the direct contact you're describing, where you would crush tick, then spread on to a mucous membrane. It doesn't take 6 hours. Then you could be infected right away.
Once again, to ask a question, press star 1. One moment, please.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Sturlo and Dr. Letterman. If there's no other questions, would either of you like to make any closing comments?
Well, I would just like to mention that everything that I've covered and more is described in a morbidity and mortality weekly report that we put out on March 31st, 2006. So it would be MMWR Recommendations and Reports, March 31st, 2006, Volume 55, Number RR4. And that is available on the CDC website. And it's called Diagnosis and Management of Tick-Borne Rickettsial Diseases, Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever, Ehrlichiosis, and Anaplasmosis. So it's a really nice practical guide for physicians and other healthcare and public health professionals to be able to look up and see anything about several of these diseases, not just Rocky Mountain Spotted Fever. And finally, in conclusion, I just wanted to say that, you know, we think our diseases are important, and it's important to recognize them, and it's important to treat early to prevent death. But on the other hand, you need to consider other illnesses too. So, you know, certainly you don't want to ignore treating possible meningococcus while you're waiting for the serologies to come back either. So it's important to recognize our diseases and to treat for them, but don't forget about other diseases as well.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Swordlow and Dr. Letterman, for providing our listeners with this information. I also want to thank our listeners for joining us for this call. In case you didn't get the chance to ask your question, please send an email to coca@cdc.gov. That's coca@cdc.gov. The recording of this call and transcript will also be posted to the COCA website at www.bt.cdc.gov/COCA. Please stay tuned for our next COCA conference call. Thank you and goodbye.